My story, in fact, started partly with being horrified as a neuroscientist when I moved to the Aston Brain Centre, amazing array of brain imaging techniques. And you notice that popular press is paying attention and you're seeing the kind of images you work with every day being used to illustrate articles in the popular press. And you suddenly start to read the articles and you think, actually, that's not what that image shows. It's nothing like as straightforward as that. This is not demonstrating, you know, at last the truth, which is very often the headings in those sort of articles, that men's brains are different from women's brains, or a whole range of other sort of profound beliefs in the differences between males and females. So I coined the term neurotrash because it was actually taking the research that neuroscientists were doing and using it or misrepresenting it, misunderstanding it, not necessarily deliberately, but trying to use these really amazing images to illustrate the message they wanted to get across.
I'm your host, Michelle King, and you're listening to The Fix, a podcast that shares the stories of women and men who are innovating and taking action to advance equality in the workplace and beyond. In July 2017, United States-based Google engineer James Damore wrote a memo entitled The Ideological Echo Chamber, in which he makes the case that while discrimination exists in workplaces, it's extreme to argue that the lack of women in leadership positions or STEM fields is simply down to oppression. James even argues that it's authoritarian to try and correct disparities through diversity and inclusion initiatives, which he views as reverse discrimination. Instead, he argues that male and female disparities can partly be explained by biological differences, as he believes women generally have a stronger interest in people rather than things, and tend to be more social, artistic, and prone to neuroticism, all of which makes them ill-suited to working in STEM fields. On August 5th, 2017, a version of the memo was published by Gizmodo, and it led to widespread controversy across social media and public criticism of the memo and its author. Following this, Google fired James for violation of the company's code of conduct. But James is not alone in his sexist views. For decades, scientists have been obsessed with uncovering biological differences between male and female brains. Dating back to the 1800s, influential scientists, including Charles Darwin, believed that women were biologically inferior to men. The racism and sexism of the theory of evolution have been well documented and widely publicized. Darwin believed that women are inferior because they have inferior brains, and therefore they don't have the right to assume a powerful role in society. Even though this is factually incorrect, Darwin's ideas, including his views of women, have had a major impact on society. Gina Rippon, Honorary Professor of Cognitive Neuroimaging at Ashton University in the United Kingdom and author of The Gendered Brain, argues that there is no consistent pattern or structure which reliably characterizes the brain so that you could say, this is a female brain and this is a male brain. On this episode, you'll hear from Gina, who'll share her research on male and female brains and the role that our environments play in shaping gender differences. You can walk into almost any toy store today, and you will likely find dedicated shelves of toys for boys and some for girls. This separation of pink and blue in society is built on the idea that girls innately like anything associated with femininity, like dolls and anything pink, and boys like things associated with masculinity, like trucks, cars, and the color blue. This simple color association is underpinned by the pervasive belief that men and women have different brains. But choosing one color for girls and another for boys has less to do with the makeup of our brains and more to do with living up to our gendered roles. Society set the standard for how men and women are meant to behave, and through everyday social interactions and activities, like buying kids toys, we come to live up to those roles. The color pink is actually a great example of this, Universally, pink is associated with girls and femininity. However, this was not always the case. If you go back to the 18th century, little boys and girls of the upper classes both wore pink and blue and other colors uniformly. Pink was in fact considered to be a masculine color. In old catalogs and books, pink was the color for little boys. It was only when manufacturers in the early 20th century started separating colors to sell clothing to girls and boys that the switch in separation happened. And so it became generally accepted that pink is for girls and blue is for boys. But this is not innate. It's something that, like gender, society creates. The myth that girls and boys are hardwired for difference stems from the belief that our brains are somehow different. Even after the development of brain imaging technologies at the end of the 20th century, which reveal how similar the brains of men and women are, the myth that there is a male brain and a female brain has persisted in both science and media. Researcher Gina Rippon calls these beliefs neurotrash, and she is working hard to debunk them through her breakthrough research in neuroscience. We live in a gendered world, where we are ceaselessly bombarded with messages about sex and gender. On a daily basis, we face ingrained beliefs that sex determines our skills and preferences, from toys and colors to career choices and salaries. On this episode, Gina will share what this constant gendering means for our thoughts, decisions, and behaviors, and more importantly, what it does to our brains.
My story, in fact, started partly with being horrified as a neuroscientist when I moved to the Aston Brain Centre, amazing array of brain imaging techniques. And you notice that popular press is paying attention and you're seeing the kind of images you work with every day being used to illustrate articles in the popular press, and you suddenly start to read the articles and you think, actually, that's not what that image shows. It's nothing like as straightforward as that. This is not demonstrating, you know, at last the truth, which is very often the headings in those sort of articles, that men's brains are different from women's brains, or a whole range of other sort of profound beliefs in the differences between males and females. So I coined the term neurotrash because it was actually taking the research that neuroscientists were doing and using it or misrepresenting it, misunderstanding it, not necessarily deliberately, but trying to use these really amazing images to illustrate the message they wanted to get across. And they're very often associated with self-help books or relationship gurus, etc. And I constantly refer to John Gray's Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus is a really classic example of neurotrash. And the reason it's important is because, again, it sustains stereotypes. They are generally very well-written books, very accessible, illustrated with very compelling images, which, if you were not aware of the kind of backstory, tell a very good story. And so trying to say to people, be careful when you look at these kind of images. There are all sorts of questions you should be asking about them, or the authors should be telling you about, which they may not be. So the idea of neurotrash, and sometimes even neurosexism in science research itself, is something that people should be aware of. You know, just a little filter to say it's not exactly what it says on the tin. The idea that the brain drives us into situations where we belong is really one of the key messages in my book, because it's suggesting that this old idea of nature versus nurture is well past its sell-by date. We can see, because we know how the brain is changed by experiences and attitudes, that nurture or the world is very much entangled with how the brain responds. And I think once people realize that, then hopefully they will see the importance of addressing some of the cultural issues that I've raised.
Scientific racism is the idea that individuals with specific racial backgrounds have inherited different aptitudes. That is, certain people are thought to have rhythm or intellect or speed or charm based on their race. This is really biological essentialism. It is an old 19th century or early 20th century problem of scientific racism, where science is used to try and explain race and gender issues and reinforce male dominance or white supremacy. This argument ignores environmental factors and the interplay between the environment and the individual, which can give rise to differences. Here, Gina shares more on this.
the idea of what we call biological essentialism certainly intersects with race science as well. And if you look at the history of race sciences as well as the history of gender science, you can see that the origins were such that there was a very powerful belief that whatever measures you took, white upper-class educated males need to emerge at the top of the scale. And very often the metrics, in fact, were manipulated to make sure that that happened. And I'm not saying that that's the case today, but there is a kind of element of being unaware, perhaps, that the measures we're using, which appear to show very strong male-female differences or differences between races, for example, may well not have a completely objective background or history or origin, for example. So I think being aware of that is very important. But the idea that this is all based on biology, with a kind of additional subtitle, therefore it's natural, therefore it's inevitable, therefore it shouldn't be interfered with, is something that we really should challenge. Because if it is something that can be changed, and if it is something which is having detrimental consequences for individuals, whether or not it's to do with how they're viewed by society or what opportunities society offers them, I think really understanding that biology is not necessary destiny, it is really important.
Gina is critical of what she sees as the misrepresentation and hijacking of neuroscience, something she calls neurotrash. She says the logic of their argument is that male and females are biologically different, so therefore men and women behave differently. So behavioral differences are biologically caused and cannot, and more importantly, should not, be challenged or changed in any way. Here, Gina shares how you can spot neurotrash when you see it.
I've got together with other colleagues, and we've written sort of almost like how-to guides, you know, 8 things you need to know if you come across and at last the truth article claiming that men are different from women, is to really say, you know, how big a population was being looked at. Are we acknowledging the fact that any differences we look at are very, very tiny? Are we ignoring the fact that the variability within groups of males and groups of females is huge? And the differences within these groups are much bigger than the differences between them. And really getting people to think, this tells me a very powerful message, but is it based on slightly misrepresented or even powerfully misrepresented research? Just getting people to be aware of what they're reading. But there's also a message to scientists themselves, because there is, which is great, I think, a big push for the public communication of science. But sometimes the story is slightly hyped, or even strongly hyped, so that talking about fundamental or profound differences between, say, males and females, when actually, if you go back to the original research, you can see that the differences are actually tiny, or they looked and made, you know, thousands of comparisons and actually only found differences in a handful of them. Are we really making sure, as scientists, when we communicate that, that the people who are reading that are aware of what we're talking about?
Much more than biology, family, friends, and society influence impressions of what it means to be a boy or a girl. This sets gender expectations that children are expected to live up to from a young age. Recent research has investigated the costs of enforced gender norms in children. One study, published by the Journal of Adolescent Health, finds that regardless of where children are from, the onset of adolescence triggers a common set of rigidly enforced gender expectations associated with increased lifelong risks of mental and physical health problems. And this continues into later life, as women face conflict in managing their gender role and the expectations that workplaces have for ideal workers and leaders, which tend to be masculine. This role conflict for women is hard to overcome, but Gina says simply being aware of it is part of the solution.
So being aware that you will encounter misogyny can help. So you get highly competent women going into an industry and finding that they encounter all sorts of negative views, that the culture is not set up to include them. So empowering yourself by being aware is important. And because belonging is a very powerful social driver, networking with other individuals in the same situation can start to put together a critical mass where the culture itself can be challenged and changed. And of course, this is true for women, but also other minorities. I mean, it's clear, most of the examples I give are for problems for young girls and women, but it's also the case that if you look at, for example, the suicide statistics in young men, the kind of pressures that our brains are under and the pathways we're put on by the world are not wholly useful for both males and females. All of this starts very early. So how susceptible very young developing brains are to the pressures of a gendered world is important to acknowledge. I think that's something which I put across. I get involved with education quite a lot to try and take gender stereotypes out of education. Now we know how powerfully they can mould children's behaviours. So education is not just about learning particular skills. It's also about making children aware of what society expects of them. And schools need to be aware that sometimes they're perpetuating a message that boys are different from girls in all sorts of ways which are not necessarily true. So they can be aware of that. So I think that's quite important.
Finally, given that gendering starts from childhood, I asked Gina if she had any advice for what parents could do to manage this issue early on.
I think, again, you know, being aware and noticing what's going on around you. I belong to an organisation called Let Toys Be Toys, which is saying to toy shops and toy manufacturers and catalogue publishers, etc., why are you perpetuating this message that pink is for girls and blue is for boys, and that pink toys are generally associated with dolls and princesses, whereas blue toys are much more interesting construction toys or superheroes, etc.? So getting parents involved in noticing these kind of differences, and not necessarily forcing children to do one or the other or banning them from playing with one kind of toy, but really saying there are all sorts of other things out there and you can play with exactly what you want to and pay no attention to the fact that they're pink or blue. And in fact, children themselves are pretty powerful gender police. You know, they're the ones who say boys can't wear tiaras and girls aren't allowed to be firemen and things like that. So yes, it's hard, but I think just being aware and always making sure that children realise that there are choices is key, but also realising that your, in inverted commas, carefully gender neutral reared little girl going to nursery will suddenly turn into a pink princess and refuse to do anything that boys do and will insist on wearing tiaras and pink tutus, etc. That's an indication that they know they have to belong to a certain group and are picking up the messages from that group. So keep on fighting. I think that's the only answer.
Gender roles are handcuffs. Being masculine or feminine is not bad. Neither are toxic. But when we don't have the freedom to step outside of these roles or decide how to behave, act, or think for ourselves, it can become toxic. For young children, it may start as acceptable to cross gender boundaries. But once it becomes clear that boys and girls are meant to behave in certain ways, stepping outside of this will lead to them being shunned or ostracized. That's why raising awareness of the challenges that gender roles create and how they're just rarely socially constructed is the key to freeing everyone from having to conform to them. Thank you for tuning into our episode today. We're nearing the end of the year. So next week will be our last episode for 2019 before we take a 2-week break over the holidays. Just a quick reminder that if you're interested in partnering with us or being a guest on the show, then please reach out through our website, thefixpodcast.org. You can also sign up to our weekly newsletter and contribute your story there. Thanks again for tuning in, everyone, and I'll catch you all again next week.